This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, and welcome to today's Barron's Live. I'm Abby Schultz, a senior writer at Barron's Penta. And with me today is Laura Lott, president and CEO of the American Alliance of Museums. We're going to be talking about the challenges that museums face throughout the pandemic and beyond, and then also efforts to address diversity, equity, access, and inclusion throughout museum operations. Welcome, Laura. It's great to have you with us today.
Great. Thanks, Abby. It's great to be here.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone tuning in that you can write in your questions, and I'll try to get to them before our time is up today. So Laura, can you start by telling us about the American Alliance of Museums? Who are the members? What's the group's purpose?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the American Alliance of Museums was founded 115 years ago in 1906, really to unite the museum field. And we say A to Z, art museums to zoos, and everything in between. So botanic gardens and children's museums and science centers. From the largest institutions that are household names to the really small institutions that exist really in every zip code in the country and serve those local communities. Today, we're a community of about 35,000 museums and museum professionals. Yeah, and we believe the world is better because of museums. And we at AAM believe museums are better because of AAM. So our mission is to champion museums and to nurture excellence in museum practice. So as such, we're sort of the chief advocate for museums here in DC and around the country in partnership with others. And we're the accrediting body for museums.
Oh, that's an important role, I would imagine.
Yeah.
the accreditation. And that advocacy I know has been important for museums, particularly during the pandemic. And we talked in the thick of it, and at the time you were estimating that museums across the country could lose $33 million a day, which is a huge amount, just from having to close as a result of the pandemic lockdowns. Can you give us a sense of what institutions went through during that period and really what they're still dealing with today? I know that's a big question, but.
Yeah, you're right. It has been a really tough time for lots of reasons and lots of people, and it continues. But last March, 99% of all museums had to close. And with that sudden kind of shuttering of their doors, most of their revenue also went to zero virtually overnight. At the beginning of the pandemic, you're right, we know that museums were losing about $33 million a day collectively. Most people don't realize that museums rely on admission fees and event rentals and retail sales and their gift shops and cafes and that kind of thing for their survival, as well as the very small charitable donations and memberships that, you know, come from everyday visitors. While the large gifts and the endowments tend to make the news, they're really not the norm for most museums. So not being open was really devastating to museums financially, and as well as for their morale, for their missions. Museums exist to welcome people, and not being able to sort of be there for their communities in a way to help people have a place of respite, a place of inspiration, a place to process traumatic experiences. Museums really were struggling to figure out, you know, what to do. And as you say, it continues. While most museums are reopening, their attendance is not, for the most part, nearly back to what it used to be, either because of health concerns and state and local mandates to reduce capacity. And also just because, you know, tourism obviously is just coming back. International tourism hasn't come back. And so, they continue to struggle. And on the fundraising side, while museums are creatively finding ways to replace some of that traditional revenue model, it's falling short of what it traditionally is. So virtual fundraising efforts fell short of goals for in-person events by, you know, over a third. And Giving USA just reported a couple of weeks ago that while overall charitable giving in our country is up, was up the past year, giving to arts, culture, and humanities organizations declined 7.5%. So it's still a struggle. And museums were able to make up some of those losses through reductions. You know, there were major layoffs and furloughs that rocked our field and many parts of the sector. But of course, a lot of things museums do can't just be cut. Even while they're closed, they still have to keep, you know, the art and the history and the nature, you know, preserved and safe. And in the case of aquariums and zoos, they have to keep animals fed and safe. So a lot of their expenses continued, as well as new expenses that they incurred to prepare to reopen safely, retrofitting space and providing, you know, ample PPE and hand sanitizer and all of those things that museums are doing to keep their visitors and their staff safe.
I was surprised to hear about the decline in fundraising dollars. That's actually, it seems like such a double whammy for museums to be dealing with. I actually spoke with the museum director this morning, just coincidentally, in Ohio, who said they think it'll take 3 years to get to kind of dig themselves out of the hole that was created, you know, with a third of their revenue coming from, I think I have that figure right, but, you know, certainly a significant part of their revenue coming from events and, you know, having their facility open for events and then the cafe sales and all that ancillary stuff that you don't really think about.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's the general feeling is 2024, 2025, maybe what we, you know, we're looking at for a, you know, sort of a build back, a climb out from this tough time.
Wow. So I know that some museums, though, being museums, got creative in reaching out to their communities with lots of really cool stuff. Do you have any examples of what museums did to reach out to their communities while their doors were shut?
Sure. This is the really inspiring part. And of course, yeah, museums are creative by nature. So, you know, they leapt into action and notwithstanding the very threat to their existence, I was so inspired that museums raced to address the needs of their communities, you know, beginning last March, donating PPE from conservation labs to local health, you know, communities or health institutions that needed masks and gloves and things that museums actually do often have in their conservation areas. And then, you know, to supporting parents and teachers who were struggling to figure out how to deliver inspirational and engaging education, you know, virtually. Museums, you know, did a lot of work in all of those areas to more recently becoming vaccine sites. You know, the National Museum of Mexican Art in Chicago, I think, was one of the first to bring vaccines to the largely Latinx community of the Pilsner neighborhood there. And others, the American Museum of Natural History and the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Missouri have all done the same. Some museums did really unusual, well, things that you don't think about museums doing. So working on food insecurity and food justice, the Anacostia Community Museum here in DC, which is part of the Smithsonian, provided free meals through a Feed Their Fridge project, fridge out in their parking lot, essentially, for the local Wow. community. Yeah. The Philbrook Museum and Art Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma, created a victory garden on their campus and donated the produce to food banks. And the Old Salem Museum and Gardens they have a historic bakery. They actually produced hundreds of loaves of bread for food banks. And, you know, there's really, you know, a wide variety of things that museums did from those things that you don't necessarily think of museums doing to COSI, Science Museum in Columbus, Ohio. This is one of my favorite examples because I have a soft spot for museums' education role. But they partnered with a local food pantry to provide learning lunch boxes to children in the community. So they said, well, you're nourishing those bodies, the folks who need food, and we're nourishing the minds, which they also need equally. And so they delivered these kits with lunch and science experiments to the community, which they're continuing to do today.
That's great, because we heard a lot about the virtual stuff that they was doing. You know, there was a lot of very, very creative programming available online, where museums kind of really dug into their collections and told stories of works of art. I think the Cleveland Museum did that. They would go into their collection and tell stories of things that that people may not have even known about if they had attended the museum. But that's really interesting to hear that it was went beyond the screen.
Yeah, they're really thinking about, you know, the beyond the bricks and mortar and even beyond the buildings that they have and then the screen to really be out in communities. They also opened their spaces to schools in really wonderful ways that I hope don't go away ever. The Louisiana Children's Museum in New Orleans effectively became a school for the year in partnership with a local school that needed more space in order to be safe with its for its students. And there are a couple examples of that.
That's super interesting. Yeah, I think like in many fields, we all learn new things, right, during this time period. Just to stick on this topic for just another minute, we talked about how some museums. We talked earlier in last year about how many museums might have to close, as much as 30% of the museums that you work with might have to close as a result of the pandemic. But I know that you were able to do some things, secure some funding. But how did that go? How did that work? And did some museums still have to close it even so?
Yeah. So we've been tracking this data for over a year now. And during the first really 6 months of the pandemic, we were consistently seeing that approximately one third of museums were at risk of having to close permanently. They just didn't know how they were going to make it through if the pandemic and the closures continued for any period of time, which of course they have. So that was just devastating. And we could not accept, you know, losing a third of our institutions across the country. And so AAM and a lot of museum advocates jumped into action. And to compound that bad news, our public opinion polling showed that the public was generally unaware of the plight of museums. There were community efforts to support other small businesses and restaurants and shops. And I don't think we're aware that the same challenges faced the museum community, and they weren't concerned about museums in the same way as some of those other small businesses. So we, tried our best to get the word out, and we heard from museums through some of the press we were able to garner, and some of the data we were able to put out about what the reality of the actual financial situation is for museums. They're not just though they have this air of permanence about them because they've generally been around for a long time, they're not typically funded by the government or by, wealthy philanthropists who will just make sure that they're there. They really needed community support. And we heard from many museums that kind of awareness building really did help them to retain or rebuild, support from their communities. And people joined, even though they couldn't actually go to the museum, they joined to be supportive. And at the federal level, as relief packages began to gain traction in Congress last spring, AAM was really focused to ensure that museums were included, which wasn't a given because back in 2009, the stimulus package following the Great Recession, museums were nearly left out. And in fact, zoos and aquariums, that big section of our community, were left out. They were ineligible for funding. And so, we wanted to make sure that wasn't the case this time because we knew it was going to be vital for museum survival. We don't think about, museums in these terms, but they're a $50 billion industry and employ, three quarters of a million people. So it's got real financial implications as well as the heartstrings and the education implications if we lose museums. So museum advocates sent tens of thousands of letters to Congress, and we ultimately secured museums access to billions of dollars of federal relief funding over the last year and a half, including PPP and shuttered venues operator grants, which we know has saved thousands of museum professional jobs and enabled many museums to survive that, otherwise wouldn't have been. We did lose a few museums that just decided they couldn't make it. There's still 10% or so of the museums that we've talked to who are still in that situation, just not knowing exactly how they will make it. I think because they're thinking it's going to be several years. And while the federal support this past year and a half has been a lifeline. We're not sure if it will continue to be there in the next year and the several years ahead. And so museums are really going to continue to need some help from all sources to regain their financial health and have a secure future.
Well, at least we didn't lose as many. So that's the positive news, but it is sobering to really think about that. We're not out of the woods.
That's right. Yeah. And I fear when museums close, unlike other types of businesses that may regenerate in a new form, a restaurant closes and a new one might come back in the same spot. Museums tend to close forever when they close. And so they're collections and their artifacts and the stories just all go with them. You know, they get dispersed and they're lost to future generations. So it's really sobering to think about losing any of them.
Right, right. So one question that came in from a listener was about the event spaces, and they were wondering whether or not if museums are starting to see an increase in RFPs for private events from organizations that want to host, is that starting to increase at all?
Yeah, we don't have data on that just yet because it's a very recent development. Yeah. Obviously, that you know sure. They've been able to rehost, but I was just at the National Museum of Women in the Arts here in Washington last night, and the director told me they're actually preparing to close for renovations for a little bit, but they've got, I think she said, 5 or 6 weddings in the next 2 weeks. So they're booked up in a couple different. Oh, of course, it's great. A beautiful venue that, you know, that, and there is some pent up demand for weddings these days. So we are starting to see some of that come back, which is great.
That's great. Yeah. Actually, the museum I spoke to today, they were, you know, watching the weather for a wedding that was going to happen over the weekend. Like, and it looks good for them. So
good, good.
So I wanted to shift now to talk about diversity, equity, access, and inclusion, and which I know is a topic that you've at the Alliance have dealt with for a long time. Certainly it became part of your strategic planning in 2016, which is interesting. And so I'm curious, you know, what you identified then as top priorities and maybe how that's kind of played out since you crafted that plan back in 2016.
Yeah, thanks for asking. This is obviously a really important part of our work and a great priority of mine since I took the helm at AAM back in 2015. So, you know, museums, as you say, have spent decades talking about, you know, diversity and inclusion and trying to really diversify their programming and their exhibitions with a real focus on the audiences that they attracted, you know, trying to engage more of the communities and bringing in, you know, more racially and ethnically and other ways diverse people from their communities. But the conversations did seem to sort of change when we were putting together the 2016 strategic plan, where there seemed to be a recognition that there was a more deep structural sort of internal work to be done in most museums. And it's still the case, obviously. We've been working on it, but we'll take hopefully not the same 100 years that it's taken to get here to undo some of that foundation, but we still have lots of internal work to do. And that's really what we set out to do, to understand and to start addressing with our 2016 focus area that was officially termed diversity, equity, accessibility, and inclusion in all aspects of museum structure and programming. So essentially everything you do, everything you are, let's think about, you know, an equity lens. That came in part from some research that was done by the Mellon Foundation that showed that 84% of the staff members in art museums that were in a position that were either the directors or in a position to become directors, 84% of them were white. So we know that that doesn't reflect the country as a whole or most of those museums' communities. And when that representation doesn't exist in the museum, it's going to be hard for the museum to tell the full and authentic stories and histories and cultures that aren't represented on the staffs and on the boards.
Right. So a lot of this, of course, became front and center last summer in the wake of the death of George Floyd. There were racial and social justice protests, and in response, a lot of museums came out with statements. Statements of solidarity, statements to and pledges to do better. But there were a lot of activists who were looking for more concrete signs. They wanted to see changes in collections and acquisition strategies and leadership and access. And so I'm wondering what has happened since? I mean, this is of course happening in the midst of the pandemic when a lot of institutions are closed, but what has happened since that time?
Yeah, well, as you say, the experiences of the past year, both the pandemic and the inequities that became really clear about access to healthcare and access to space and things that would keep people healthy, as well as the racial protests following the murder of George Floyd, all of it has shown us that it's more important than ever to acknowledge that it's our diversity in our country, in our museums, in our communities. The variety of voices and perspectives that make us stronger. And while, museum leaders are tackling, like many leaders in other sectors, really impossibly difficult decisions right now because of all of the implications of the pandemic, financial and otherwise, AAM has said since, again, last March, it's vital that we stay focused on our equity. And during times of crises are not times to put aside issues of DEA&I, but really to double down on them. We've been seeing museums really lean into that, I think. Of course, a lot of the changes that that need to happen in museums they're the easy stuff has been done. They are deep and hard issues right now, and so they are going to take some time. And I know that there's a growing impatience for a lot of this to be fixed. But the reality is that to make structural, lasting change and not just sort of Band-Aid fixes to big, sticky problems, it is going to take time. And that's really what we're focused on at AAM, is trying to create mechanisms that make structural change in museums that will last far beyond the current experiences, the current memory, the current people, even in our institutions. So, anecdotally, we've seen a number of museums, rethinking their business models and their structures in service of fostering greater equity within their communities. Focusing their acquisitions even and their investments on telling stories of communities of color, which have historically been underrepresented in museums, as well as just the very tactical action of creating official positions for chief diversity officers and people who have expertise in these areas, not just interest, but real expertise in facilitating the kinds of discussions and culture change really that needs to happen to make them stick.
I've read about some kind of innovative things people have done. This is just a story out this week. The Baltimore Museum of Art is going to hold an exhibition next year that's curated by its security guards, which seems really fascinating. And are there any other examples actually that you could give, and particularly around bringing more diverse perspectives and audiences, like diversifying the audiences who go to museums, which I know is one of the issues. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the Baltimore Museum of Art initiative, and they're not alone. There are a number of museums that are taking steps towards, further integrating various voices from their communities into their planning processes. There's a term that we use in the museum field called co-creation, really involving the community. Rather than thinking that we are the only experts on, the stories that we're trying to tell because of the scholarship that the museum houses and the tradition of that and our collections, but really inviting members of the communities with different perspectives to share their stories, their perspective on it, and not focusing on the one story, but really a multitude of perspectives on any given piece of art or historic, event, or even at the Science Museum of Minnesota is another, really progressive institution that is involving community members from, I think, three surrounding metro areas to create interactive experiences at a science museum that really support you know, the understanding and the processing and the addressing of systems of racism in the Minneapolis St. Paul community. So incredibly important work, and also really inclusive, I think, not just in involving people when the exhibit is done, but in creating it.
I'm sorry. I was just going to ask, it's about bringing more diverse audiences to museums. What are museums doing to do that, to encourage? Because I know that's an issue in lots of cities, that people feel like, oh, this isn't a place for me. This isn't where I should go. It's where other communities go.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things there. One is, folks do have to feel like their perspectives, their histories, their ancestors are included in the museum. Otherwise, it doesn't seem like it's for them. And so I think it does start very early in a museum's planning with its collections and its exhibitions to make sure that they are reflective, so that people, once they do come in, feel that it's for them. And then, you know, museums are talking a lot about the relevance and the engagement that people are looking for. So even, you know, diverting for a second from, you know, issues of race and ethnicity, you know, bringing younger people into museums with more of the engaging kinds of things that, you know, folks want, gaming technologies, and instead of asking them to put away their phones, actually how you embrace and use the phone in the museum to enhance the experience. And so there's a lot of work to be done in really ensuring that the museum experience is one that is kind of modern, if you will, and also inclusive of those communities. And I think it's also why you see museums going outside of their four walls, because we know that many of these places are, they're just in their very appearance intimidating. You walk up the giant marble steps into the grand entrance, and, you know, people who don't have a history of doing that, regardless of how they identify, you know, aren't sure what to wear, aren't sure how to act, aren't sure if they'll be, you know, asking the right questions or whatnot. And so trying to just make the museum more approachable, more, you know, open to, right, to everybody is a key priority.
And you've been doing a lot of work at the board level too. I know you've had some grant funding specifically for that, and have been working with 50 museum directors or museum boards rather. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, back in 2017, right after this strategic plan focused on DEA&I, and we started collecting data, we actually did a survey that revealed that boards were underrepresenting, you know, racial and ethnic minority communities. And so we, with support from the Ford, Walton, and Mellon Foundations, we launched a program called Facing Change, Advancing Museum Board Diversity and Inclusion. I think it's one of the most ambitious DEAI initiatives in the nonprofit sector, and certainly one of the only ones aimed at boards, because a lot of the work is done at the entry level. And so we've been building inclusive board cultures and inclusive governance practices among these 50 museum boards. And we have, in the last year and a half, despite the challenges of the pandemic, placed over 100 new racially and ethnically diverse people of color on those boards. So it is a soup to nuts program. We're really
That's great. That's a real tangible change, and it seems so important, because, you know, what happens at the board level really filters down throughout the throughout the institution.
Absolutely. They set a tone.
Yeah. So one question I wanted to ask you, maybe related, but it is about the return of cultural artifacts, which it seems to be happening more. I'm just seeing more headlines about it. There's the Benin bronzes, which were taken, from what I understand, by British troops in the 19th century, perhaps. It's from what is now Nigeria. And there was this German museum that just returned a Tian Lakota leather shirt from a chief to his grandson, or great-grandson, rather, which seems pretty cool. But can you I guess I'm wondering if you, if there is a trend here, if you, do you think more museums are going to be looking at how to return cultural objects to their communities of origin?
Yeah, undoubtedly, I think we can expect, you know, continued conversations around decolonization and returning those cultural artifacts to their communities of origin. I think there's a greater just understanding and appreciation for why having those discussions are important, putting aside some of the legal rationales for why museums have certain things and really thinking about what's the right thing to do.
Right. So in many cases, they did acquire them legally, but yeah. Right. So I guess just a final question, just where do you see museums heading from here? And maybe you've touched on this a little bit, but just the role of museums in society and why it's something we need to be thinking about and protecting.
Yeah. Well, Abby, I'm an optimist. I have to be in this position. And, you know, I think museums are in a position to lead our next renaissance. I mean, for many reasons. I talked about the economic rationale, their role in education infrastructure in our communities. Yeah. And then just their importance in preserving our culture for, you know, current and future generations. But they're also vital to bringing people together, to dialogue, to, you know, talking with each other about, you know, issues of critical importance to our society, to our democracy right now. I think museums have a huge role to play. They may be the answer to many of society's issues, from Black Lives Matter movements and understanding the history and the context for where we are, to, you know, building awareness around climate change and other issues. So I think it's a tall order, but we museums are ready to rise to the occasion in big and small ways, and, you know, hope that our communities will continue to be there to support them.
That's great. Well, thank you, Laura. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but it was really wonderful to speak with you and to learn more about what museums are doing and the important role that they play in communities, and that they need support.
Thanks, so, Abby. I appreciate
all good messages.
It.
So to our viewers, come back on Monday. Barron's Live will be back then with Lauren Rublin, who is Barron's Senior Managing Editor, and Ben Levison, who is the Deputy Editor. And they're going to be talking about the outlook for financial markets, industry sectors, and individual stocks. So thanks, everyone. Stay safe and healthy.